Bright, everybody. Hi, this is Candace Adewale of The Loving You Lifestyle, and welcome to another week's podcast. We are going to be talking about women and real estate investing this week with real estate investor expert Latrice Williams. She is a remote real estate investor, broker, and contractor from Chicago. And Latrice, I would like you to start off just telling us a little bit about yourself and how you got into real estate investing.
Sure. Well, first of all, hey, everybody, how are you? I'm hoping everyone's doing well. I actually started, I have an MBA in marketing and I have a master's in urban planning. And so I have been doing corporate, like the kind of traditional corporate jobs for a long time. And ended up in sales. And so I was comfortable working from home and running a home office just based off of my corporate gig, and kind of came to this, you know, I'm doing this for other people, for somebody else. I can do this for myself. And so it was more about, okay, I'm going to work for myself. So how do I facilitate that? And I really had a passion about real estate. I mean, I love looking at property. I could look at homes all day long. I love seeing something that is completely destroyed or that might not have the best usage, and changing something about it to make it beautiful and to give it this profit-making potential. So, or this realization from the potential. So it was an ability to, it was two things. It was becoming an entrepreneur and working for myself, working from home, and then also doing it with a field that I had a passion for, which was real estate. So I kind of came into it that way.
Awesome. Yeah, I have a passion also for just watching things being built, making something out of nothing. And you definitely have to be a real visionary in order to do that. I want to know, what is it that you have learned, or, you know, before I jump into that question, I want to ask you, as far as the type of real estate investing that you do, can you explain a little bit about the type of real estate that you started getting into as when you started investing and what you currently do now?
Sure. I have a real estate brokerage license, so I broker deals as well, but my main focus has always been flipping houses, buying something. You buy, they say you make your money when you buy something at a pretty low price, renovating it, and then putting it back on the market and hopefully realizing a profit from those efforts. So that is what I do. I spent time at the beginning of my real estate career having rentals. I've also had Airbnb properties, but right now I'm just really focusing on the flips and not holding things, just trying to build up my capital, and then I think I'll probably buy some properties to hold at that point again.
Okay, nice. In all the years that you have been doing this, what have you learned as far as determining what's a good deal versus a bad deal?
It's absolutely cliche, but it's truth. Location, location, location. I only work in Chicago. And the reason I do that is because I know that city. I would encourage people that are looking to start real estate investing to, you know, look in your own backyard. That can be more challenging if you're in a city like New York, where there's nothing in your backyard under $1 million kind of thing. But you really have to know the market that you're in. And I think that's a little bit easier when you are in a space where, you know, you're from there. So that's thing one, is to kind of, you know exactly the market that you're dealing with. And then beyond that, kind of knowing what your overall strategy is, what your long-term strategy is, and how you want to invest in real estate. I decided to flip because, you know, that's something I'm passionate about. I think it's a way to use, I always say it's the left and the right brain, because I can find something that is, you know, a mess and make it very, very beautiful. It's just a creative piece. And I do a lot of the work with the architect and getting the design and stuff done But then also there's this analytical piece, because I'm always putting the financing together and finding like the good deal. So, I mean, that is like the other thing that you always have to do is to know that you are getting a good deal, which is, you know, you have to buy it. They say you make your money when you buy. You have to buy it at an incredible price. As a friend of mine says, you don't want a deal, you want a steal. So you, right. I mean, that, and it's hard, but you know, that's the best thing that you can do is get something. You're not going to pay retail on this. You got to get it at a really, really good deal.
When you speak of location, how do you feel about those who would like or are thinking about investing in some of the lower income areas and perhaps building it up? What do you think about those type initiatives?
I mean, there are so many real estate strategies that can work. I mean, tons of them. I am cautious about that because for several reasons. When I first started flipping houses, I did my first one in Inglewood in Chicago, which is one of the kind of the higher crime areas in the city. But what I learned quickly was that it's difficult to get money from, because you're generally using other investors' money to purchase and do your renovation. And it's difficult to get money in these higher crime areas. So financing is always a challenge. When you're looking to sell it, you're having issues with a lot of buyers not looking in certain areas. So then that's a separate challenge, because what I like to say is I like to do stuff in areas where everyone's looking. And what tends to happen with a lot of the lower income areas is it becomes only Black or only Hispanic, and you are limiting your amount of potential buyers or tenants if you're going to rent it out. So if it's a economically diverse area and it's also a ethnically diverse area, you're maximizing your potential customers. So there's that. There's also an issue with crime in a lot of the areas that are still kind of in the process of gentrifying. When I did things in some of the higher crime areas, you're worried about things like as soon as you put something into the property, people are stealing it. So you're spending a lot of money, a lot of time on security. And some of the nicer neighborhoods, people just don't do certain things, or it's a much lower occurrence of it. But you might, I mean, I've had situations where you put the copper into a property and then you come back the next day and somebody took it all out. Or, you know, out the walls, not like the boxes out the room, but they like tore down the drywall and ripped the copper out the walls. So, you know, you are dealing with the security piece. You know, you worry. It just opens up a multitude of issues that aren't things that you have to deal with in higher income areas. Then when you go to sell it, I mean, those, a lot of times, if it's a higher crime area, the people that are looking to buy in those areas or renting those areas have kind of a weaker, if you're selling, they have a weaker file. So it's a lot of times harder to get them approved to buy. But if you're renting in a lot of those areas, you can do like Section 8. And then, you know, there's tons of people that have Section 8 that will absolutely, if it's a nice place, they'll take it. And so, you know, that's a different strategy. So it just depends on what you're ultimately trying to do. I was reading an article in Chicago that there was a woman who had all these Section 8 apartments and houses all over the city. I mean, like, it had to be over 100. And she was making close to $1 million a year just in rents from her Section 8 tenants. So, and wow, they had all the addresses posted, because this is freedom of information, get that. And they're in some of these neighborhoods that are actually pretty bad. So you can absolutely, like, you can take advantage of that. The other thing I wanted to talk about when you're talking about investing in areas that are up and coming is, depending on how far it is in that trajectory, if you are the only person or if there aren't a lot of people that are investing in it, you can really lose money, because you buy it and you invest in it thinking, okay, in 5 years and 10 years and 20 years, it's going to pop, and it doesn't. So for example, in Chicago, Chicago thought it was going to get Chicago was going to get the Olympics in 2016, and it didn't. So people had, when Chicago was putting its bid together, people were buying all this property on speculation. And the neighborhoods that they were, like, a lot of the proposed sites were were in areas that were a bit blighted. And so it was like, well, if Chicago gets done living, they're going to build all this stuff and do all this stuff and there'll be all this development. So people were buying on speculation. And then when the Olympics didn't come, people just didn't make the money. And then like a couple years later, the market crashes and, you know, people lost money. And so, right. You know, at that point, it's just like the gold rush or something. It's the speculation and you're taking a bit of a much stronger gamble. I mean, the payoffs can be high too. If, you know, if Chicago had gotten the Olympics, people probably would have made a lot of money, but when it didn't happen, you know, you bought a lottery ticket that didn't win, you know, you basically just lost. And then at the same time, you're still going to be carrying taxes and all that sorts of thing for something that might be in a neighborhood that like the property, the land value is less than the taxes that you're paying. So it's like I really hate these shows that come on HGTV that, you know, they show these renovations and they're done in like 15 minutes. And it's just never that. They never talk about how people get the financing together, which is for me the hardest part. Everything else is compared to getting the financing together. Everything else is cake. But that's this huge thing. And then you have to meet the criteria of the lenders that you're trying to work with. And then their criteria shifts depending on the market. Like right now, the market's strong, so people are giving out money a lot easier. But when the market crashed, I was working at GSA, which is no one knows what GSA is, which is so crazy because it's the largest landlord in the world. It's the federal government in the United States. And they, if you go every Social Security building, post office, wildlife reserve, that's all like managed by GSA, national parks, all of that. So this, even when you go to the airport and you go through like security check-in, this is the federal government is actually having leases at these airports to have their agents in that space. So when I worked there, it was like in 2009-10 when the market was like still in this kind of really weird space where people just could not get money. There were people who had these guaranteed government contracts. Say, you know, the U.S. federal government was like, we will pay you, you know, $30,000 a month for 20 years if you build this Social Security office in this neighborhood. And people, there were developers that had lines of credit with Chase, and Chase would be like, so, and they just take it away. So even though you thought that like you were going to be able to do all these things because you thought you had this money, the lender just came back and said, well, no, I know we gave you this letter of credit, but it's under our discretion to take it back. And the market is just, we're not confident enough in the market right now to let you keep that. And so, you know, this ever shifting landscape. And it's not something where it's just predicated on one thing. It's supply, demand, the market, the economy, what people are thinking, preferences of buyers and sellers, what the government regulation is, what the city, county, state, federal government are doing in relation to what you're trying to do. So there's like this, you know, when I got my real estate license, the instructor was like, it's like trying to herd cats. And it really is trying to herd cats in the dark with, you know, no hands and being deaf and it's just very, and there's an earthquake happening. It's a very, very kind of dynamic situation.
Well, it sounds like it can be a little bit daunting. And I know with my personal journey in owning property, I personally kind of stepped in it completely unprepared, just completely unprepared. I didn't know what I was doing. All I knew is I wanted to buy a house, and I really got screwed on my first deal because I think I was like 20 years old when I purchased my first property. And I had absolutely no knowledge. So I want to ask you, what are the top three mistakes women make when getting into real estate, or just three mistakes in general when people get into real estate?
Okay. I mean, I can kind of answer both of those. I think as women, one of the things that I've heard from some women is that, you know, buying real estate is this thing that comes with a relationship. Like when I get married, I'll do X, Y, and Z. And one of those things is buy a house or buy a condo or whatever. And I would encourage women that excuse me, have an interest in investing in real estate to not wait for this relationship that may or may not come. If you want to buy some real estate, don't wait for your husband. And that's something that I don't think, you know, I would need to say to a man. If a man wants to invest in real estate, he's going to do it. So that would be, I think, mistake one is waiting for this external hypothetical person to come in and say that it's okay or facilitate the purchase. The thing that I think is kind of a catch-all for people is not knowing what their real objective is. And I've learned so much just because I've made so many mistakes, and I've had, you know, some crazy things just happen where, you know, it forced me to learn lessons. I've learned a lot of things about kind of just the permitting and the laws and the rules of Chicago, just because I've had so many crazy things happen within the Chicago city limits, which is why I like to focus on the area that I know. So I think that is one thing. I think people, I don't know if there's like a top three, I'll just kind of give like, you know, some short things that I would say to watch out for. Buying in neighborhoods or areas of cities that you don't know. I think that's huge. You know, don't say you're sitting at your computer in Connecticut and you see some deal in Detroit and you're like, oh, I'll just buy that. And then you realize that you bought something in a neighborhood that nobody likes. The zoning's crazy. There's $50,000 in back taxes and you don't know how to resolve it because you've never dealt with Detroit. Like, don't do that. Buy something in an area that you know. And if you absolutely want to buy something in a specific area that you don't know, then learn that area. So you got to know it. So I think that's thing one. Thing two is like going back to what I was started to go into, which is kind of knowing what it is that you want to do. If you're going to flip. If you're going to flip properties, then all right. Are you doing single families? Are you doing two flats? Are you doing, like, what is your investment strategy? And kind of latching on to an investment strategy and just drilling down into it until you get as much of an expert in that space as you can. If you're going to be a landlord, then understanding what it is about being a landlord. You're looking for different things if, and then also what your goal is when you buy. I think one of the biggest mistakes that home buyers make is I think people buy property like they're buying a car. And cars and houses should not have the same kind of, I don't believe, have the same mindset when you go into looking to purchase. When you buy a car and you buy a brand new car, as soon as you drive it off the lot, it depreciates because, you know, it's worth less than the next person because it's not new anymore. Well, homes have really kind of come to be the same thing. The stuff that's in the house right now is what's on trend. And the trends are constantly changing. If you go to a home show today, it's completely different from last year, from 3 years ago, from 4 years ago. The appliances evolve. The color schemes evolve. The finishes evolve. And so if you buy something at the top of the market because you fell in love with the floors or, you know, the light fixtures or something that you can absolutely change, in 5 years, if you want to sell it, it's not new anymore. And unless the market is appreciated enough to make up for the fact that your house is now old, people are going to look at that like it's an old house. And they're not going to pay you the same thing they would for the house next door that could be exactly the same on the outside, but the finishes are more new. So I think when you buy as someone who's going to live in the property as an investment, you know, you're thinking, well, you know, home is the biggest investment. And it's kind of not when you buy it that way. I actually did this, and I recommend this to people too. Something to consider. Buy an investment property that you don't want to live in because that's not an emotional decision. You're going to buy something that makes sense financially, you should, and then rent the thing that you think is awesome because that's not really an investment unless you're going to stay there for, you know, 20, 30, 50 years or you're never planning to sell it. But the way that the market is, for most people, that doesn't happen. They buy a condo and then they get a new job and they want to sell it, you know, in 5 years and buy something else, or they get married and they want a bigger place and they have kids and now they want to move to the suburbs. And so you have this property that you paid too much for, you can't get out of it. So I guess the other thing is just kind of like you need to, I'm rambling, but I feel like these are is more than just top three things. Is you buy property with the exit in mind always, even if you're looking to, you know, if this is going to be your forever home, you know, looking at it as, okay, if this is going to be my forever home, then if I buy for this price, will I be able to comfortably make the payments? And, you know, even if the market doesn't change or worst case scenario goes down in 10, 20 years, will I make money? Will I lose money? I mean, you know, if nothing else, you should at least be able to get out of it what you put into it. So that's the other thing. And then I guess kind of like common sense, don't be house poor. Don't buy a house that you can't really afford. If you can't make the payments or whatever, or making the payments means that you have to compromise every other aspect of your life. That's kind of silly. Like, just buy less house, or, you know, maybe go to a different neighborhood so that you can still, you know, go out to eat or travel or do the things that you were otherwise doing. Because at the end of the day, it's just, you know, some walls and some floors and light fixtures.
Yes, I think that is very, very critical. Not buying something you can't afford. And that was one of the things that, you know, one of the mistakes I made when I first purchased my home, because I was in the mindset of a renter and thinking that all I had to do was pay my monthly mortgage, which also included my insurance and my taxes. But I didn't consider other things like, okay, well, if something in the house breaks or needs repairs,
yeah, absolutely,
that's
when taxes go up.
Right, exactly. And so taxes increase and things like that. Those were the expenses that I didn't consider when I first, when I purchased my first home. I want to move into real estate.
If I could just another thing that people just kind of always, they don't kind of take note of, and when talking about the monthly costs of owning a home. If you buy a condo, especially if it's a new development and you're in a subdivision and there are anything with assessments, with a new development, the developers, like everyone who's at the front end of a deal trying to sell the property to you, the more you spend on it, the more money they make. So they're not going to try to talk you out of something that you can't afford. That with a condo, they might set the assessments at like $150 a month, and everyone's like, oh, I can afford that. That's nothing. But then once the condo development is done and they turn it over to the actual owners and you get the building, you're like, well, that's not enough to actually build up reserves and pay the common area insurance and blah, blah, blah. And then in 10 years, you need, like, you know, to get the roof treated and you need these huge capital expenses. So now the assessments might go from $150 a month to like $500 a month. And you didn't budget for that. Especially if you bought at the very top of your price range. So a lot of people in condominiums end up getting pushed out of the property because they can't afford the assessments once they become real. Because when it's a new development, they're always going to have the assessments super, super low at the onset, because the developer wants you to be able to afford as much condo as possible. So you can pay, you know, you can buy a $500,000 place when you probably should only be buying something for $375,000. But if you're paying $150 assessment, okay, sure, you can swing it. But now that you're paying a $500 assessment and then still the note on a $500,000 place, now you're stuck and then you're facing foreclosure and blah, blah, blah. So just understanding that those assessments on a project that's just been developed are not real numbers. They're absolutely going to change. And of course, the taxes go up with the value of the property. If the property appreciates, your property taxes go up. And that's a reason in a lot of lower income, in a lot of neighborhoods that have gentrified, people lose their property because they can't afford the taxes. So you'll have these senior citizens that bought their home, you know, 30 years ago, and, you know, they completely paid it off and the property taxes were like $1,000 a year. And now that, you know, everyone and their mama decided that they want to live over there, the property taxes are $20,000 a year, and you have somebody on Social Security and they can't pay that. And so they are having issues maintaining the property taxes just based off of the fact that the neighborhood is appreciated and they didn't do anything. but now they're priced out just off the taxes.
Right. No, those are all wonderful things to consider, which again leads me into the next topic, which is funding. And we kind of touched on it just a little bit, I recently was on Instagram, and there's this new investment guru. I forget what his name is, but he's pretty young. He's a millennial. And anyways, he's quite motivating. And he was saying how he's learned in his real estate experience that money is like the least important part of the equation, because there is always money to be had. Like there are always people looking to invest in certain things, and that money is plentiful. But I want your take on it. How can someone who would like to get started in real estate investments be able to find the funding? Where do you get the money to start your projects?
It depends on what it is that you're trying to do. All those gurus, I mean, I shouldn't say this, but I mean, I think 80% of what they say is absolute garbage. There's maybe 20% that's applicable to what you're trying to do. And I don't care what it is that you're trying to do. They're trying to sell seminars. So they're going to say whatever. A lot of that stuff that they give you is so generic, and real estate is hyper-local. If there is a meetup in your area, that is where you need to go and get real estate investing advice from, because they know what's going on in your city. If there is some national guru, if you try to buy, if somebody tells you, oh, I can tell you how to get property on tax liens, and that's a county thing, and there are dozens of counties in the United States. Each city can have multiple counties. And so what happens in one county is different from another. So somebody, and then that's predicated on state law. So you go to some place like Nevada where they don't have judicial foreclosure, and you're trying to buy something from a tax sale, you can get stuff a lot faster, you know, because you can just get somebody off the house real quick. But in Illinois, for instance, that's a judicial foreclosure state. There are people that can stay in, you can stay in that property 2-3 years. So you bought a property on some tax liens, and it's going to take you, you know, 2 years to get them out. So, and the other thing is, you have to, in Cook County, which is in, or Chicago's in Cook County, you have to buy tax liens, you have to, because I kind of muddy tax liens and foreclosures. To buy a tax lien property, you have to be delinquent in your property taxes for up to 2 years. And the person has to buy 2 years worth of delinquent taxes before they can evict somebody out of that property. And they only have a tax sale once every 2 years. And what tends to happen is you get like hedge fund managers that come in and they just buy like, you know, 100 properties in one day. So then if you're like some small time investor trying to like use other people's money, that's not going to work. You're not going to like do it that way. But then in Texas or Nevada or California, where the laws are different, that might fly. So again, you got to be in the area that you know the laws in and you know the rules. And then you can kind of play in that space because you know what's going on. So, so buying a property with no money, it is not easy. What a lot of people do tend to do is like the wholesaling. You don't need money to wholesale. And that's something that you can do. And so those are the people that typically do the like we buy houses kind of thing. And they put the, you know, they call people like, hey, you know, I see that your property is going to foreclosure. Let me buy from you. And so it's harder now because properties are a lot more, either if they bought them before the market crashed and that property still hasn't gotten back to like market value, the people might owe more than it's worth, and then that's not even worth pursuing. But if you find the person who they're in foreclosure, they just want to get out of the property, they owe $200,000, you think the property might be worth $300,000. So you say, okay, I'll buy your property. You give them a contract for $200,000, and you take that contract and you have it as an ability to assign. You take that contract and then you shop it to an investor. And the investor's like, well, you say, okay, hey, I got this contract for $200,000. You pay me $10,000, it's your deal. And the contractor or the investor's like, oh, that's awesome because it's worth $300,000. Sure, of course, I'll pay you $10,000 to make $90,000. So that is how you can kind of get in with no money down. And that works pretty much in, I want to say almost any area. There are, you got to find the rules around contract assignments in the city and the state that you work in because it's always, you know, they could be different. So that is a way to kind of get in with no money down. Now, the other thing is, you know, I don't know who this dude was that was talking that you were saying this thing about, but a lot of communities, I'm a black woman from Southside Chicago. If I need $50,000 and I call my mother and say, Mama, I want $50,000, she will hang up on me. There are a lot of people who can do that, though. I never understood how much money some people have. I rehabbed a house in Chicago and sold it to these grad students at the University of Chicago, and their parents wired the cash for the purchase, like $550,000. It was just like, it was a gift. There are people who can absolutely do that. So in a lot of communities, when they want to start doing things like investing, they could just go within their family and get the money. And that, I mean, that's not everybody, but that's a surprising amount of people. That's like when you see HGTV and they're doing House Hunters and someone's like, you know, their job is a glass blower and they're looking for a house in Hawaii and their budget's $3.5 million. It's their parents. And so there are definitely people that do that, and that's how they get the money to start doing what they're doing. The other thing is people, if you're like working a regular 9-to-5 and you make good money, you have good credit, you can definitely get a loan. You know, you're still going to have to come in with, for an investment property, you're supposed to come in with about 20% down. The market's really good right now. Some lenders are going, you know, 10, 15%, depending on what you're able to find with a private loan, but you're generally going to pay a higher interest rate. If you come into an investment property and you say that you're going to live there, that's illegal, but people do it. And, you only come in with like 3% down, and you can, to buy a home to live in, not as an investment property, you can say it's a $100,000 home. There are a lot of grants across the country for down payment assistance. And the financial limitations vary from state to city or whatever. There are programs and what the limits are. So like in San Francisco, if you're probably making, if you're buying a property that's like, I think 700,000 last time I checked, somewhere around there was affordable housing. But in a place like Little Rock, Arkansas, I'm just guessing it's probably like, you know, 150. It's probably like the right ceiling. So you have to do a lot of research and find out what city programs there are in your city, what state programs. Nobody markets this stuff. The banks that, and a lot of these are facilitated by like national banks. It might be a program that you have to run it through Chase or Wells Fargo, but they don't promote those programs, so they don't make any money off of them. So you have to really know what programs are available in the area that you're in. So if you get you found a program that's like, okay, we'll give you your down payment assistance, like Nehemiah and stuff like that, NACA. That's a national program. And they'll give you like 3% down. And so you find a house for $100,000, you get your 3% down from them. You ask the seller to give you closing cost credit. So now you've basically got 100% financing, because you're going to have to bring $6,000, $3,000 for your 3% down if it's an FHA program, $3,000 for your closing costs, and which the seller is going to carry. And that's a completely legal vanilla deal. But that needs to be an owner-occupied property. If it's not an owner-occupied property, the bank finds out it's not an owner-occupied property, they can absolutely take legal recourse, and sometimes they do. So those are kind of some of the basic strategies for like quote-unquote no money down. But it's definitely a challenging kind of thing to do. They always say cash is king. If it's the other part, I wanted to say this. What I would find is that people wanted to deal with those types of programs where they were like, okay, I got down payment assistance, I got an FHA loan, I got a FHA 203K loan, which is FHA's rehab product. It takes like 45 days to close minimum. Well, they're looking at the properties that are like at the cheapest properties. Well, the people that, the really good, well-priced properties that are on the market like that, people buy those in cash. Nobody's going to wait for your FHA 203K loan to close. No one's going to wait 45 days for your loan to close when they can get somebody who has a lot of money in the bank. And there are people who have insane money in the bank. Like, you know, they'll buy a $2 million property and wire the cash. And so if you are sitting up there thinking you're going to get some financing and buy a property that is priced insanely well, that's not something you're going to get. What I would suggest to people is if you are financing, you can't look for that incredible deal. Like, I mean, anything's possible, but it's so hard to get. You're better off looking for that, like, not quite the best deal, because you'll actually get that. They're not getting as many offers. They'll work with you. They'll wait. So if you know, the market value is $100,000 and then they drop something for $75,000, don't even try. You're not going to get it. It's going to a cash investor. But if you have a loan and there's something that comes up for like maybe $95,000, $90,000, you could maybe get that, you know, and that's where you should put your energy, because you'll lose your mind. You'll get frustrated after you put 10 offers in and you still haven't gotten anything. So.
Right. One of the things that I want to share with the listeners is that Latrice lives here in Italy with me, and I met her here in Rome. And so I think it's interesting that you are remotely investing in properties in the U.S. And you also have some new projects that are coming up that you're working on that you shared with me. And I want to know if you would be willing to share some of the new projects that you're working on as far as real estate here in Italy.
Okay. Well, yeah. So one of the things about working, well, the new stuff that I'm doing here is people, because I have this background in real estate and I live in Italy, people always ask me, are you working on real estate in Italy? And so initially the answer was always no. And again, I go back to like, you gotta know where you are. I didn't know the rules here. I didn't know like what, anything that is about buying property, how the market is or any of that. But now that I've been here a little over 2 years, I have a much firmer understanding of, you know, prices, the rules, the laws, the processes, like all the things that it takes to buy property here. So I don't specifically, like, I'm not a licensed broker here. I don't broker deals or anything, but I consult with people who are looking to buy property in Italy, generally Americans. And if they, you know, are looking at buying something, I'll talk them through like suggestions, and I connect them with a real estate agent here, an attorney here, Natalia, which is kind of like, for all intents and purposes, the kind of on par with like an escrow company or a closing agent in the States, and helping them kind of through the process and managing their expectations. So that is the real estate business that I'm doing here, which is kind of cool. You know, I'm learning a lot about, even more about like kind of what needs to happen to get a deal done here, and what the markets are like across the country, because Italy is a very small country. It's about the size geographically of Arizona, but it's a lot more condensed. And so within that condensation, it's like all these markets, and everything is so different from, I mean, not just with real estate, but the food, the wine, the culture, the language, the slang, everything. And so real estate is no different. And so Sicily is different from Rome, is different from Milan. And I'm really beginning to understand more and more about that. So that's kind of what I'm doing in this space.
Now, you hear some of these claims, and I know I had approached you about it, where there's certain rural towns in Italy that are selling properties for like $2 or €2, something really, really crazy. Or there are towns that are willing to pay people to come live, and then because they're dying towns, what sort of potential, investment potential, do you see for that?
I think somebody just asked this on social media yesterday, and I responded. I think if you're going to buy a property anywhere in the world as an expat, you need to buy property someplace you want to live. And not look at it as an investment property. That's a completely different thing. Unless not being somewhere remotely and trying to manage an investment property in another city in the United States is like this impossible thing. Try doing it in another country where you don't know the laws and you don't know the rules and you're not physically there. And there's this time difference. I mean, you pull your hair out. I don't know why someone would set themselves up for that. So in Italy, what I see is some of these properties that are like €1, from what I understand, the property might be €1, but it has €300,000 in repairs. There's a reason that they're only selling it for €1. And once you do all the work, it might still be worth 100,000 euros. So now you've lost money. It's not like a property where, you know, you get it for a euro, you put 200,000 euro in it, and now it's worth like a million euro. It's still worth like very, very little. These are towns that, generally speaking, have tiny populations because there is no commerce. And so I've met enough Italian people here and enough Italians that have moved abroad to know that, I mean, there is, in a lot of those smaller towns, there is very little economic opportunity. Because there's little opportunity, that's why. It's like Detroit. You know, there are abandoned mansions that used to be homes to Ford and GM execs, but it doesn't matter if there's this gorgeous house, if there's no one in that immediate area to actually be in that space and have a job and afford to live there, and there are no schools and there are no hospitals and there's no support to actually live a life. And so that's what's happened in a lot of these smaller towns. For instance, I met a guy who is Italian that lives in Germany, and he's from this small town that's close to Nice. And it's this thing where there's like no jobs, no opportunities. And so, yeah, you can get a property there for next to nothing. But now you have this property that needs all this work that probably has a lot of taxes, back taxes, unpaid taxes that also need to be paid. And then in Italy, when you buy property, you have to pay, like in other places, you have to pay tax every year. And so you're paying property tax that might be worth, that might be higher than what the property's worth. In addition to the amount of money you had to pay on renovations. And then it's in the middle of nowhere. So the town that he's from, and I can't remember the name of it, but I know he has to fly into the airport in Nice in France, and then he has to take the train for like 2 hours. So a lot of these towns are also disconnected. So it's like they're like in the middle of nowhere, which if you are planning to live here and retire and you don't care, you're like, I just want to live on the countryside of Italy, and I don't care if I'm 2 hours from an airport or I'm, you know, an hour and a half from the closest train station. Like, none of that matters to me. If that's what you want, then absolutely buy it. But if you are looking, if you're still, you know, you're not retired and you need to have like a school and, you know, a lot of businesses and economic activity, and, you know, you want a post office that, or not just a post office, but like a UPS and, you know, a really nice hotel and all those sorts of things, it might not have those things in that particular city. And that is why they're giving the properties away, because they want people to come and kind of build this stuff up. But you have to be aware of what it is. I mean, the properties in Milan are a million euro because Milan is this, you know, bubbling center and hub, right, and international city, and people want to live there. But, you know, some, right, of these other towns, the properties are really cheap because of the, you know, nobody wants to live there.
Right, right. So basically, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. But I mean, I guess it could be a potential opportunity for people who would be willing to put in a great deal of time and energy and money and being like pioneers, I guess. But Italy, me living here, the amount of time that I've been here, I can say that the system here is completely different. So
absolutely. But the challenge I would I think people really have to be aware of is, I mean, a lot of these villas, it's almost like the, you know, under the Tuscan sun, where, you know, that was a much more vibrant area that she was in, but the home needed all of that work. And that's what it is. Right. You know, you might end up buying this villa and you need to put, you know, 150 or 200,000 euro in it, which, okay, but then what if it's still only worth 50 or 75? I mean, if people, right, aren't moving to that area, I always tell people, you know, they're like, oh, my appraisal, my house appraised at this, and it's worth this. Your house is worth what people will pay. Not a cent more. Right. If people won't pay 500,000, it's not worth 500,000. It's worth 400 or 300 or 200, whatever. Not the number you arbitrarily have set in your head. And so you have to, I think that the caution with some of those deals here is just making sure that you don't buy into an area where you're going to have to put all this money into it, and it won't be worth what you've put into it, you know? You just have to do a lot of research. A lot of research.
I did. 100%. That is the place in which I find myself with my investment property right now, because it was appraised at a certain price. and it's on the market to be sold because I could not do with the property what I had wanted to do with it, because the renovations cost me much more than what I was willing to spend. But, you know, I'm finding that now that I have it on the market, that people are only willing to spend maybe $20,000 less than what it was appraised for. So the number that I have is really worthless at this point, because...
Well, that's unfortunate, but it's what it's worth.
It is unfortunate, but it's real. That does happen, and so I'm glad that you brought that up. I'm going to go ahead and wrap up our conversation by asking, do you have an email address or something like that that you can maybe give in case someone wants to contact you with specific questions regarding real estate, or if they want some of your professional time regarding specific questions?
Sure. If anyone wants to reach out to me, they can email me at italrex1@gmail.com. That's I as in ice, T as in Tom, A as in apple, L as in lake, R as in rabbit, E as in elephant, X, the number 1@gmail.com.
All right, awesome. Well, Teresa, I want to really thank you for taking the time to come on the show this week and to talk to us about real estate investing. I definitely would like to have you on again in the future to kind of pick your brain, because the more I talk to you, the more I realize that you're just a wealth of knowledge about a lot of things, not just real estate. So hopefully can have you on again. But
no problem. It was a pleasure.
Well, thank you. And I want to thank all the listeners. Thank you again for your time. If you want to reach out to me, you can reach me at blissfulfemininity@gmail.com. I'm going to ask that you go ahead on our Instagram page, Loving You Lifestyle, and like our, follow us on Instagram and like our Facebook page as well. You can again reach out to me by going to my email. That's blissfulfemininity@gmail.com. My dog is our bargain bin. All right. You all take care and stay blissfully feminine. Ciao.
Ciao.